Automatically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows your screw.
Your brain is filling with adrenaline right now. Whether you know it or not, your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little louder to breathe. The neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. Do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
You're listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener-supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Revolution. Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Cosmic Catastrophe on FreedomSlips.com, Revolution Radio in Studio B. Every Saturday noon, my lovely co-host Leah Shaper, it was a little hectic moments ago. She was muted and disappeared, and I thought she might have been lost forever.
I made it. I fixed my technical problems.
Today, we're going to continue the conversation that we had last week on the year 536 AD being the worst year to be alive on Earth. And it's bigger than that. It's actually a whole decade of nightmare, plague, famine. And this time frame, we didn't even allude to it last show, is often referred to as the late antique Little Ice Age. Is that correct?
That is correct. And so really you could say that it goes even beyond a decade because the little antique, late antique Little Ice Age. Am I echoing again?
Not on my end.
Oh, darn it. Supposedly extends from about 536 to about 660. So whatever's going on in this time frame seems to have an impact on the climate for a while, unless it's just a coincidence.
Yeah, can you see the screen?
Yep.
So here's a graph of that time frame, the late antique Little Ice Age, and it is beginning, in fact, right there at 536, and It's extending well into the future here. And like we said on the last show, it's almost 100 years, it is 100 years plus, until they really start smelting metals again in the section of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, clearly societies were heavily affected by this, and that's really no wonder. I mean, we talked last week about the Justinian plague and how a small shift in the temperature can make it possible for the bacteria that causes that plague to really spread rapidly. So it's not surprising you see the effects for quite some time.
Yeah, and in this graph, it says the onset and establishment of the Justinian plague. So this is, in fact, the first time it shows up on Earth.
Oh, well, as far as we know, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting. I mean, interesting to note, too, that, you know, in recent years, there have been little cases of bubonic plague that have showed up here or there, and that may be due to our global temperature dropping just a bit.
Yeah, we do have bubonic plague even in Colorado, a few cases.
Yeah. Well, and to clarify, bubonic plague is a bacteria that's always around. It's just a question of whether or not creatures are getting sickened by it.
Yeah, here, within 5 years of the onset of the late antique Little Ice Age, as researchers have dubbed it, the Justinian Plague pandemic swept through the Mediterranean between 541 and 543 AD, striking Constantinople and killing millions of people.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I read somewhere that it's estimated that in the Byzantine Empire, which is centered on Constantinople, they lost about a quarter of the population. But then there were further waves of bubonic plague after that time period as well. And I'll also throw out there, and we'll look more closely, I think, in the future at the dates, but in the like 1150 to 1250 range, we see the bubonic plague show up again. And again, the temperatures are lower in that time period.
Yeah, exactly. So these drop downs in temperatures cause a number of things. And there are a lot of people that speculate that in certain areas, up to 80% of the population perished during this period, starting in 536.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is
I would imagine that it's very...
Go ahead.
I would imagine that it's really hard to get accurate population numbers because who knows how well the population was actually being tracked and how they were tracking deaths. And I mean, we can't even do that today, right? I mean, look at the garbage data we get, you know, out of some of our federal alphabet institutions around disease.
Yes. More interesting I'd like to bring up here is 536 AD. From that point all the way into the Renaissance, Rome has fallen, right? We've got all these amazing Roman cities. And in 536, there's no one there. They're completely abandoned. And no one goes back to fix anything, to build anything, to do anything until the 1400s. What are we doing for 900 years? Are they just walking through Rome?
Right. I mean, we tried. Okay, right. The Western Roman Empire falls in 476. The Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, is still going for quite some time, I think until 1400 or so. And they do go back and try to recapture Rome, and they do succeed briefly, and then they lose it again. Because with all of this temperature shift, it's causing so much social upheaval because it's like hard to get food, and so then you end up having wars. The Arabian Peninsula apparently was actually doing quite well during this time period because they were getting a lot more rain. So for them, there was fertility and food abundance, and some of the Arabians started messing with the Byzantine Empire and winning because they're doing well, and the Byzantine Empire is just like scrambling to hold on.
So we can clearly conclude that climate change is controlling the societies in this case.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it has nothing to do with CO2.
No.
The rest of this show we're going to get to is going to be on, we're going to come up in the end here with our own hypothesis on what has happened. There's lots of papers that suggest comets came, you know, and that's what they talk about. There's mm-hmm. some papers that say that volcanoes erupted, and that's what they talk about. I don't know of any paper that has a concise theory about what actually happened on this. We even shared a paper that didn't talk about almost any of that and said that, yeah, none of that was happening.
Right, right. But we'll get there, but it does look like, and it does look like some researchers are at least leaning in the direction of that multiple things happened, that we had a volcano or maybe more than one that was pretty significant. And that also we may have been impacted by something from the cosmos. So it seems like there's multiple things going on here, which I think is going to be supported by the evidence, because it's hard to find anything else in the history that has as significant an impact on the Earth for as long as it did.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to jump around here as far as the papers we're going to discuss, we're going to jump around in dates. We're not going to do it chronologically.
Yeah.
So we're going to start with this 2016 paper, Cooling and Societal Change During the Late Antique Little Ice Age from 536 to 660 AD. Where was it? Okay, there it is. Climatic changes during the first half of the Common Era have been suggested to play a role in societal reorganizations of Europe and Asia. Well, we just said that, didn't we?
Yeah.
And in particular, the 6th century coincides with rising and falling of civilizations, pandemics, human migration, and political turmoil as well as happening at this time. Now, according to tree ring chronologies from the Russian Altai and the European Alps, what they did was they reconstructed summer temperatures over the past two millennia, and they found unprecedented, long-lasting, and spatially synchronized – that's a great sentence. So long-lasting and spatially synchronized cooling following a cluster of large volcanic eruptions. So we've got volcanic eruptions, boom, 536, there's one, 540, and 547.
And then this is backed up by other papers that find layers in the Greenland ice core and as well sometimes the Antarctic ice core too of volcanic activity. So you get layers of sulfates, acidic layers. Now, some of those dates are not quite as well coordinated, but some researchers have even gone so far as to suggest that what they found would indicate a slight shift in the dating of the GISP-2 to coordinate with other data. Like this data might be a point of calibration for the GISP-2.
Oh, yeah, because it's such a significant event, of course. If it's that easy to find in tree rings because it's that recent, then right. You should easily be able to find it over here in the ice core. And if it's showing it's skewed a little, then your dating of your ice core is probably off.
Right, right. There's one researcher, Larson, who makes a really good case for that in a 2008 paper.
Yeah, and a couple new papers coming out. They're revisiting the carbon-14 dating method and showing that it varies. It's highly variable based on sunspots and other cosmogenic things happening. So what they're coming out with is a type of carbon-14 time analysis adjustment graph, where if you're taking a sample from this area, you got to add years or subtract years to make that type of dating more exact, because we've learned over the last few decades that it has problems and inaccuracies.
You know, what makes me wonder, too, if things like the GISP-2 are being coordinated with changes like that in C14 dating, right? Because GISP-2 is so specific. I mean, you get down to actual dates. Like February 24th. I'll just give you one example. In a 2008 paper that Dallas Abbott was involved with, she talks about a layer of iron oxide magnetites and silicate spherules that appear in the GISP-2 from February 24th, 536 to August 28th, 536. I mean, that's so specific.
That's right before my birthday.
Yes, it is. It's leading up to your birthday, but, you know, a long time ago.
Yeah, indeed. All right, so we have lots of different data sets that are corroborating multiple volcanic eruptions happening, three of them, in fact, in succession, boom, boom, boom. And bad things are now happening on Earth at this time, starting with maybe a volcanic eruption. But you and I have talked about this. Maybe the sequence of volcanic eruptions was knocked into gear or started or kicked off by an impact that happened in the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Right. I mean, there's ample evidence of a cosmic impact in this time frame. What the mechanism is and what the relationship between volcanoes and a cosmic impact, I think, is definitely up for debate, but it's a pretty interesting thing to ponder.
Yeah, and as far as so I think it was 2010 when the first paper came out, Cosmic Catastrophe in the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Abbott's involved in that paper as well.
Yeah. Yeah. She has a whole series, a long series of abstracts about the Gulf of Carpentaria, because she's been working on notating impact craters around the globe. And so she has a whole series of abstracts showing what was found in the Gulf of Carpentaria. And there are a bunch of layers showing impact of a cosmic impact of some kind. So there's some fragments that look like meteorites. They're very metallic. They have iron. They have nickel. They have chromium. We've got magnetic iron oxide spherules, silicate spherules, some nearly pure carbon spherules, probably some shocked quartz. I mean, there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff. Oh, here is one that's interesting. There is vitreous hydrous calcium phosphate containing lots of magnesium and sodium, which she talks about might indicate Whitlockite. Are you familiar with this mineral?
Never heard of that mineral.
Well, apparently it's like an unusual form of calcium phosphate, and it would be indicated by the presence of the magnesium and the sodium. And apparently that could indicate a chondrite meteorite. Like, this is not something that it's rare. I mean, there are other forms of it. It's not necessarily a meteorite, but that's one possibility. So there's a bunch of really interesting stuff in there. And we should at some point talk about the diatoms that were found as well.
Let's get to that in the second half.
Yeah.
Together, and we'll just present the evidence of what's going on here. Now, in the 2010 paper, which as Abbott and five other authors, I'm just going to read a little bit from the abstract. Accounts from the distant past have recorded stories of a global climate cooling event that lasted 18 months, beginning in March of 536 AD. I love how we now have a month. March 536 is the beginning of the end of the empire. A debate has ensued for decades about whether this event was due to volcanic or extraterrestrial impact. Well, we now know that there's three eruptions that are happening, one in 536 and then two others within quick succession. But now in this paper, they have two crater candidates in the Gulf of Carpentaria, and it's the Canmare and the Taban crater. And these may have been the site of a comet impact. The impactor was approximately 600 meters in diameter and would produce enough dust to have caused major cooling for 18 months.
Yeah. And just to clarify, when we say comet impact, we're not talking about a full-on comet hitting Earth. We're talking about a piece of a comet potentially hitting Earth.
Yeah, comet is a rough word definitionally, because like we've argued about the difference between comets and asteroids. Mm-hmm. It's one half a dozen of the other. These are definitely charged objects that are coming in and hitting Earth. In this case, they hit the bottom of the Gulf of Carpentaria. And where they did hit on the shore here, so I do have a graphic here.
Yeah, right in that southeastern corner there.
Right. And what would that would do? It would keep the tsunami damage isolated. I was looking at a paper this morning, the one that we were looking at a couple days ago, that showed that within the last 50 years, there was a tsunami in Alaska that was measured at 500 meters high. Do you remember that?
Oh, I thought that was like around 1850 or something.
Okay.
Was it more recent than that?
No,
yeah, but still. Yeah, that's huge.
It was isolated in a bay. So what happened is it washed, like it destroyed everything up the mountains on the side of the bay, but it didn't really propagate out. So no one knew it happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, Abbott has looked at these two craters, and she's noted that we've talked about this on the show before, that there are chevron dunes in this bay here that don't align with the wind direction, but they all point back towards these craters. And it's where is that? The height of the chevron dunes is actually quite different for each one. One reaches like 70 meters on shore, and one only like, I don't know, 4 meters or something, 40 meters. Yeah, that's probably a function of the topography, I would imagine.
Yeah, and so this is the Gulf of Carpentaria, and the location of the impacts are down here at the bottom. And we discussed this, like you can clearly see there was destruction up here, up on the shore, where all this material was removed recently. And you can see that if you just pan out, that white area.
Yeah.
And that would correspond to one of the impacts. We had located the Chevron Dunes before. I don't remember where they are.
I don't really remember exactly either. But there have to be a bunch of them in that bay. Because like you said, a tsunami caused by an impact there would be largely contained in that area.
Yeah, yeah. And we easily found them last time because I had located them before.
Yeah.
And then there's evidence like this where this sand area goes way inland here and is not the actual shore, that something had penetrated in here. You could see more of that washout here mm-hmm. on the shore here. And that would have been all contained within this bay.
Yeah.
Like if the major waves washed up here, they're not getting out of there.
Right, right.
And so all this, these impacts then also have been dated.
Yeah. Well, there is a estimated C14 age of 572 plus or minus 86. So it's still a pretty rough date, but that's a lot better than what the estimation was before. Before that, it was like 70 to 900. So that's way too wide. But 572 plus or minus 86 is definitely in range for 536.
Yeah, and the 536 volcanic eruption, we discussed this before, isn't big enough to darken the skies on Earth.
Yeah.
So there's a problem. So something else, just based on critically thinking here, if we have a volcano that's erupting at that time, great, but it's not a significant enough eruption to darken the skies. So something else has to be happening.
Well, and you can see that too, just by comparison. We talked about Ilopango in El Salvador last time, and that, you know, caused destruction for like 80 square kilometers. It was probably a VEI-6, and that didn't darken the skies globally.
No.
You know, I mean, you would need such a massive volcano. I don't even know if it would like register on our scale.
Well, we had Tambora in recent past, right? 1815, mm-hmm. VEI-7, that didn't darken the skies.
Right. Right. You got a year without a summer, but it didn't really darken the skies.
So you need a VEI-7, five of them equally spaced with a VEI-8 maybe just to use volcanoes.
Right. Right.
So that's not what's happening here. We have volcanoes going off at the same time two objects hit the Gulf of Carpentaria. Now, what this will do is this will put cubic miles worth of moisture up into the stratosphere and the atmosphere that will last for 18 months and will literally wash out the sun. It would look like it's constantly cloudy and you can see the like blurry sun behind it. That would be the veil of moisture.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you want to get into this just yet about the evidence in the GISP-2 for these marine impacts. Do you want to get into that right now?
Well, let's hint at it because we're about to go to commercial.
Yeah, okay.
But first, let's sum it up. We've got a volcano erupting in 536, and based on the fact that that will not darken the sky at the same time, and maybe the volcano was kicked off by an impact, boom, volcano erupts, and it gets dark. So. And the Gulf of Carpentaria is tropical marine. So let's talk about the diatoms.
Yeah. Okay. So, and I'll try to get through this quickly since we're going to go to commercial here. But so in the GISP-2, right at the 536 layer, and this is very specific, this is 536 plus or minus 0.41, right? So it's pretty precise. You get this layer of marine diatoms, and the species is low latitude specific. And it is also shallow depth specific. So these are not like deep sea diatoms or something. The diatoms that are found are the largest concentration of diatoms ever found in any ice core. And like I said already, they were specifically marine, low latitude, shallow depth.
And now, shallow. There you go.
And shallow, right? So like a bay is perfect.
Well, and the two impacts happened on the shore of the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Right, right. And then add to that, the diatoms are found amongst a bunch of calcium particles, which would be from calcium carbonate, which is very common, right? Calcium carbonate is everywhere. It's shell, it's bone, it's reefs, it's all of that. There's tons of it on Earth. However, the calcium this is kind of specific, so I don't want to rush through this, but the calcium is pretty specific, likely to be marine-related, and it's an extremely high concentration. So in this layer, they find it at a concentration of 575 micrograms per liter, where over a large section, the average is only 72 micrograms per liter. And the max concentration that they find other than this is 87 micrograms per liter. So this is a huge amount of calcium. And what Abbott suggests is this calcium represents like a marine dust, that it's like 80 times the background level. Not only that, it's calcium, so it's white or gray, which means it's going to be great at reflecting sunlight, and it's going to be great for nucleating clouds.
Yes, yeah, so is like,
that might be the darkness right there.
Definitely. So, and the instant cooling, you increase the albedo because of these light colored dust. The impactors are in a shallow marine setting where you're going to get calcium carbonate, you're going to get shallow marine diatoms. And remember, the Gulf of Carpentaria is in the southern hemisphere, and this data is coming from Greenland.
Yeah. Right. Right.
You so know, the and, only and again, way you can yeah, the only way you can blow up something in the southern hemisphere into space, you have to blow it into space to get it to Greenland. So this right. is a huge impact. And the Aboriginals, they have stories. They've witnessed some huge impacts in Australia.
Yeah, I was looking at, there's a huge number of impacts across the Australian continent. And there's a paper that I didn't really read, but is all about the Aboriginal myths of stuff falling from the sky. I mean, it was like way more than could possibly be related to this specific time period, so I didn't get into it. But it would be worth reading, right? Because this continent is clearly seeing a lot of impacts.
Yeah, there is a story. I think we read it weeks ago here. I had it up and I might have shared it, but there is a story of twin falling stars that were moving to the north.
Oh.
And the Gulf of Carpentaria is in the north. And so people were standing in the middle and they watched twin shooting stars and then, you know, probably heard a boom and then it got dark.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and I recall reading somewhere as well that recently in the Chinese records, there's some reference to hearing a big boom from the south.
Ooh, and with that, we'll be back in a few minutes to wrap it up.
Who owns you? If you're not in control, then someone else is. Join me, Ivy West, for Voices on the Wind, Saturday. I discuss government, health, metaphysics, suppressed science, universal mysteries, little-known incredible facts, alternative energies, and even more than you can imagine. Won't you join us on Revolution Radio Saturdays for Voices on the Wind with me, Ivy West.
There are lives in the balance, people under fire, children at the cannons. There are...
Because if your head's in the sand, your tail is a target.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the Internet. Please help support this station so this battle can continue forward. Revolution Radio!
There have been imaginative science fiction writers for generations.
Be invasive.
But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
I'm aware of some archaeologists that have uncovered large bones indicating giants in Virginia. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before. always an Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down and...
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford. Join me every Thursday night in Studio A at 6 p.m. Eastern for Factor Theory Live. Find us on www.revolution.radio. Great guests and great stories. What do you believe?
Join me and the Brian Ruse Show on Revolution Radio, Eastern Standard Time, every Tuesday night from 6 to 8. We talk about the four most vital things, in my view, affecting all of humanity. Number one is UFOs and aliens and their agenda for the advancement of humanity. Number two is the Jewish establishment's control over all aspects of human civilization. Number three, the truth about Adolf Hitler, how he was the opposite of what we've been told. Number four is advanced ancient global civilizations. Join me on the Brian Ruse Show, Tuesday nights from 6 to 8 on Studio B on Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
All right, so when we left at the break, we were talking about some historical accounts of what's going on here, 536 AD, and I brought up some aboriginal accounts of twin shooting stars, and Leah, you shared about an Asian account?
I don't remember the specifics. I just kind of read this in passing, but yeah, it was a Chinese account that mentions hearing a big boom to the south.
To the south, which is exactly... Yeah. Where we're talking about here.
Yeah. So that's pretty interesting.
So here's the Gulf of Carpentaria. There is way straight north of there is where you got Japan and China. So one group down here is seeing twin stars fly to the north, and another group up here is hearing a big boom to the south.
Yeah, and the twin stars, that's pretty interesting too. We do have two craters. Abbott does note that based on the evidence that she found, that they're definitely two distinctive craters. So there's got to be two different objects, and maybe they're falling at the same time.
Yeah, one is like 6 kilometers wide crater, and the other one's like 10 or 11.
No, actually, it's 18 kilometers and 12 kilometers. So okay. Khanmar is 11 miles across, and Taban is 7.4 miles.
Yeah, so two different objects, pretty significant. And with this hitting water would do exactly what we need it to do at this time, and it's to make it dark.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also introducing a lot of moisture into the atmosphere, like you suggested. And then we have the calcium factor being injected into the atmosphere, which is going to reflect sunlight really well. So.
I read a paper this morning that there was also tin. And that's interesting.
Yeah, and in the GISP too, in this time frame, so like 533 to 540, you find nickel, which would indicate something cosmic. We talked already about the iron oxide spherules. You find those. And then there's these injections of cosmic dust And it's we mentioned this in the last episode, but it's worth noting that Halley's Comet passed by in 5:30. The Chinese recorded it August 29th of 5:30, the day after your birthday, to September 27th of 5:30. And Halley's was brightest in 5:30 and then also in 12:22 later down the road. But one of the things, what I think is going on here is you've got Halley's Comet coming in to the solar system in 5:30. And maybe while it's here, you've got pieces of it that broke off from like solar tidal forces or whatever. And then those are orbiting around in our solar system. And eventually we've got two big pieces that crash into Earth. And you see the evidence of the cosmic dust before 5:36, which is probably because of Halley's presence. So you get like the first cosmic dust injection at like 5:33. And then that declines until 5:36. You get a new injection, 5:36 to 5:37. And then you get another one from 5:38 to about 5:40. So maybe also that's like passes of these pieces that have broken off.
Yeah, it's a shortening length. So the periodicity of the orbit, it's getting closer and closer until it hits us.
Yeah, it's like making a, I didn't think about that. It's making like a suicidal like spiral into Earth, right?
Yeah.
And maybe there's an electromagnetic force at play here in it falling into Earth, right? Because obviously a comet is charged, so fragments of it are also going to be charged, and maybe that plays a role here. And maybe also playing a role in the volcanic eruptions as well.
Yeah, because they could be pulling on the magnetic field or on entry, or they could be jarring the crust when they smash.
Right, right, all of that.
So that giant tsunami was in 1958, that recently.
Oh, here wow.
Here it is in the paper.
It's huge. I mean, just look at the size of it by comparison to the other tsunamis on that chart.
500-meter run-up.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah, by and the way, also,
I
did find my notes about the Chevron dunes, about the Konmar and Taban craters. So for Konmar, you get these Chevron dunes that are 70 meters above sea level. And for Taban, they're only like 4 meters. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And we'll have links to all these papers below so that you can do your own homework and your own research. On page 210 of this paper, which is a 2009 paper, it talks about the Gulf of Carpentaria craters. And it also covers the Chevron dunes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said earlier, Abbott has done a ton of work on what's going on in these craters and analyzing the material that they found in a layer that is clearly magnetic. Right. So that's another indication of an impact. You've got this like 1 centimeter layer that's magnetic. And she even says at one point that there's gravitational anomalies as well, which is kind of interesting. But you find markers in these layers of cosmic impact, as well as the markers of there being an impact at all, right? Like you find a lot of vitreous material, and sometimes the vitreous material has microfossils inside of it. So some of that is just an indication of a terrestrial impact, period.
Yeah, because you would need that to be sitting there, then you need it to melt and be put into the object. So that means that it's an impact. Here we have microspherial evidence also in magnetite.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we clearly do have impacts happening in the Gulf of Carpentaria, which is kicking off massive climate and social change at the start of the late antique Little Ice Age. Yeah. Does this have the graph? I mean, yeah, take a look at how cold it got here and how rapid.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a mini Younger Dryas event, like I alluded to in the last episode. So right here where you'd be just – here's the natural background variability in climate, right? Right here there is a vertical line that drops down 1.5 degrees C.
And it's right at 5:36.
Yeah. And then a few years later when we have this second volcanic eruption, and isn't 5:40 – Ilopanga or
no, Ilopanga is actually much earlier than this, 4:31.
Okay, so the second eruption is keeping it even colder, and here it might be the 5:50, a third eruption.
Yeah, and even is that? That's a little hard for me to see. Okay. I mean, there's some evidence in, like, I think the GISP 2 that there might have even been an eruption around, like, maybe 529. But that could also be a function of, like, if the dating in GISP 2 needs to shift a little bit.
There's a deep spike right here at 529.
Well, that's what I was just looking at, is that spike right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That might have been kicked off by Halley's, which is 5. Isn't that when it first comes
530.
Around?
530. 5:30 is Halley's. So Halley's is approaching at that point.
So this is potentially the most significant cosmic catastrophe in recent memory. It's only 1,500 years ago.
Yeah, and that the point that you made about this being kind of like a mini Younger Dryas, I think, is very relevant. And a couple of other people have mentioned that too, that there's such a strong correlation with this, you know, massive temperature drop that happens all of a sudden.
Right, and the objects during the Younger Dryas were spanned over we talk about it starting maybe 17,000 years ago, the actual Younger Dryas event, or maybe even 40,000 years ago when a big comet entered, and that the Younger Dryas event is the culminating event of that whole cosmic catastrophe sequence. Mm-hmm. This is a much smaller type, right? We have Halley's Comet passing, maybe some debris gets shifted in the normal Halley's orbit, which doesn't hit anything, and mm-hmm. then it closes in on us based on that cometary dusk, and then boom, it hits the Gulf of Carpentaria and it gets dark.
Yeah, this is almost like a mini case example to explore a catastrophe on Earth, right? And then the big question is what is the relationship between all of the variables? What's the relationship between the cometary impact and the volcanoes and all of that? What causes what in sequence? And that's the hard part to untangle, I think. You know, and part of that is because we've got scientists who are working on this that sort of have different paradigms about things. Like, I'll just give one example of a paradigm difference that comes up when you read all of this stuff. So in some of Abbott's papers, she tries to make a distinction between the material of comets versus asteroids, and that's because she's using the old model of a comet being a dirty snowball that's like covered in rock, right? So it's like ice inside and then rock outside. Now, I think what she's doing when she's trying to make a distinction between the chemical signatures of those two things isn't useless, because I would argue that there might be a material difference, because a comet is charged and an asteroid or a meteorite is not, which is going to bring about some chemical differences between the two. So it could be that the differences that she's maybe seeing when she analyzes those materials is not a function of a dirty snowball versus a rock. It's a difference between two rocks, one of them being charged and one of them being not.
Exactly. And for further research, we'll refer you over to the Thunderbolts Project and a lot of work they've done on the electric comet.
Right, right. And why it's not a dirty snowball.
No, we've actually landed on a comet, and there's no ice there.
Right. And yet we still continue to talk about them as if they're dirty snowballs. It's really bizarre. If we had a cohesive view about what all of these things are, like I believe the correct view is electric universe theory. I think it explains just about everything going on in our solar system. If we all adopted that view, I think it would be a lot easier to determine what the relationships are between variables in all of this. But right now, it's a little tough, and there are a lot of different pieces that are here.
Well, I think we put it together pretty well.
Yeah.
And based on the instantaneous drop in temperature that we're looking at here, you need a significant event, and we've already determined that it's not going to be a single volcanic eruption, even if it's VEI-7.
Yeah.
So this drop down in temperature, the beginning of the event that's the climate shift, is going to be the impacts in the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Yeah. I just mean the part that we haven't figured out is the sequence of what causes what. You know, why is it that we have these volcanoes going off and these cosmic impacts at the same time? And does one cause the other or vice versa? All of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because a larger and better example, it's mimicking it again, is the Younger Dryas event. Mm-hmm. Huge amounts of volcanism happening in British Columbia, right? All the volcanoes down all the way down through California are erupting at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Massive amounts of melting, massive climate shifts,
mm-hmm.
massive
mm-hmm.
amounts of water in the atmosphere. a wet period that lasts in Africa for another 6,000 years after the event.
Yeah.
That's a big version of what we're looking at right here, which is the mini Younger Dryas, 536 AD, the year without a summer. And some.
Yeah, and you kind of said this briefly already earlier in this episode, but I think what's happening is that when we have a strong electromagnetic interaction with a planetary body, like a body that comes into our solar system, I think it's shifting the electromagnetics on Earth, and or an impact is causing such a perturbation in the crust. It's maybe both of those things. Because, you know, we already see that, like, for example, when we have a coronal hole on the sun facing us, we tend to have more volcanism, right? And that's heating the muons in the mantle, correct?
Yeah. That's cosmic rays would be doing that.
Right. So there's it seems to me like it's an issue of the electromagnetics largely.
Yeah, and so that brings into play this amazing graph that a lot of people are unaware of. And then this is the solar activity for all of the Holocene.
Yeah, this is an amazing paper. I haven't really read it. I just kind of browsed it, but it covers the dynamics on the sun over millions of years, and it's incredible.
Yeah, and there is really no grand minimas during 536. It's a high solar activity time. It's during this gray spike right here.
Yeah.
So there's no correlation to the sun to this event in 536 AD. So to have the full picture, when you're coming up with a theory, which is going to be a hypothesis on this event, you'd have to look at all of the data. And so by looking at this, this kind of eliminates the sun as being a factor.
Yeah, it does. In fact, it's a little hard to tell on this graph because the resolution is low just because we're covering such a broad time period. But when you really look and try to line up 536 with that graph, it very clearly is happening on a solar maximum, a weak solar maximum, but a solar maximum nonetheless. But then you see that dip in temperature that happens after the fact.
Yeah,
it's just that first little dip would be the late antique little ice age there.
This one up in the gray.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking the next blue dot, but that's too far.
Yeah, that's at 640.
Okay, so supposedly this time period ends, the late antique little ice age ends around 660, so it might be part of the equation.
Yeah, so it's this first drop down and then the blue, because that's where 660 ends.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is the newly named, it's so many letters.
I know. It's Lalia.
Lalia, the late antique little ice age.
Yeah. Well, then even more interesting, right? You go forward to about, 1250, starting around 1250, right?
Yeah, that's the big deep dump.
And we know there's a big volcanic eruption right there, Mount Somalis. And we again have this like cool time period, and this is I need to correlate the dates, but I'm guessing this is around the time that the Black Plague, the second incidence of bubonic plague, surfaces.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. What year?
1256, I think, is the eruption.
Yeah, that's the second wave.
Yeah.
You know, and the beginning of the Dark Ages that most people refer to, when in fact the Dark Ages go all the way back to the beginning here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess you could argue we had two dark ages, or maybe it's all just one continuation, because certainly the solar activity is kind of low during this whole time period.
Yeah, and there's really no buildings that are built during this time period. Like historic, like all the Roman buildings are built, then it all ends around 500. Nothing else is built until like 1400. It's weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's like civilization is on standstill here, you know, and you and I have talked about how it seems like there's like big chunks of history that are missing during this time period. But that makes sense, because if you're busy surviving and finding stuff to eat and avoiding the plague, a lot of other things become much less important to do, like recording your history or building buildings or silversmithing. You know, we've talked about how the signal for silversmithing doesn't reemerge until like 650 or something, right?
Yeah, it takes 100 years just to start smelting stuff. Now, what's weird is that the Renaissance paintings that start coming out, this rebirth of art, they Latin is a dead language that resurfaces 700 years later and they care about it. It's like, what's going on? They try to pretend that they're Romans again. So go ahead.
Well, no, that's interesting. Yeah, because, okay, certainly the Christian texts are still going to be around and they're going to have been written in Latin. So probably I would guess that you've got this horrible period where it's very hard to survive. And then things kind of climactically get better in the Renaissance period. So let's say like starting around like 1300, right? Maybe even 1400. I guess 1300 is maybe a little early for Renaissance.
Yeah.
And so, but that makes some sense, right? To have this, if those texts are still around, to have this resurging interest in that, where you're like trying to rebuild civilization, you know, and if you still have those foundations in Christianity, it makes sense to me that you would go back to the Latin.
Yeah. But here, let's add some more intrigue. When you look at the paintings that are coming out of collapsed Rome during the time of the Renaissance, it's depicting that everything is still there. There are statues, 1,000-year-old statues still erect that no one pillaged during this time. Like they just left the city there for 700 years. You know, they didn't touch it. Mm-hmm. And then they reoccupied it. It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
When you look at the art.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if a lot of that is a function of the Byzantine Empire, right? Because it's like this whole time period after 476, after Western Rome falls. And then for a long period of time, you've got the Byzantine Empire that's kind of hanging on and trying to rebuild itself. You know, they actually go back and try to recapture Rome, and as I mentioned earlier, and they do, but then they lose it again. So maybe the Renaissance stuff is a function of that Byzantine Empire, which is still around until about 1400.
Yeah, interesting. But a lot of people say that during this period, maybe some of the time noodling, where they erased time from our history or extended it.
Right, right.
And this is the time of where a lot of people talk about the mud floods.
Oh.
And in fact, because of what happened in 536 AD, during the Renaissance, when they went back to Rome and looked at, and there's pictures, paintings of like the old buildings, they are buried about 18 feet in mud.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can clearly see it in the artwork. And so what's happening, and most of these Roman cities are right by rivers. The rivers came up hundreds of feet during this event, hundreds of feet. So it was like it was referred to in some of the literature as the second deluge.
Really interesting.
So anyone looking for a mud flood connection, it's going to be 536 AD and the decades after during this dark period.
That's so interesting. I mean, and it's almost as if, like, because of these climate catastrophes, it's almost like you have people purposely rewriting their history almost.
And forgetting about what happened. So it's not until you scientifically look at it, you know what happened, but it's not in the literature.
Yeah, which is interesting, right? Because we still do this today. We still fail to acknowledge large catastrophes that have happened on Earth, and we still continue to pretend like this doesn't happen. I would be inclined to think that that's a natural outgrowth of the elite, right? If you're a power-hungry elitist psychopath, and you want people to believe that you have your hands on the reins, you probably don't want to acknowledge large catastrophes that clearly are out of your control.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that the society is so big. What it does is it creates a more vulnerable planet to almost any scale cosmic catastrophe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like all we need is a small rock to hit the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah.
And the whole world as we know it will change in six hours.
We're so, so vulnerable.
The whole financial industry in New York would be wiped out within 7 hours.
Yeah.
All of the wealth and 80% of the wealth in the perimeter of the Atlantic would wash out to the sea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely bizarre to think about. It's not something that's talked about. There's no college class called the end of the world or cosmic catastrophe.
or like these, you know, little catastrophes that can happen that can entirely change the everything, every part of the way of life on Earth, and there's nothing we can do about it.
No wonder the human species is suffering from amnesia.
Yeah.
No wonder. It wasn't just the Younger Dryas event 12,000 years ago that's genetically imprinted in us, although it is. It keeps happening.
Like you and I have talked about often, this idea of the zombie apocalypse, right, that seems to come up in our memories and our imaginations again and again and again and again and again. Why are we so obsessed with this zombie apocalypse? Is it somehow related to something that we experienced, like a plague of some kind? I mean, that actually seems like a very familiar theme considering what's been going on these days.
Yeah, and it's a cascading effect. It's not like you can dodge the bullet. If once a cosmic catastrophe begins, there's a whole litany of things that occur after. So it's not bad enough that you're, you know, thousands of miles away without you witnessing it, two rocks hit a little bay in northern Australia, and then moments later, the skies go dark for a year and a half. And during that year and a half, everyone starves to death. People lose their mind. Then if you're trying to claw back, right, 4 years later, and then the plague hits, and then you watch 80% of everyone else die. This is crazy times, and of course you're going to want to forget it.
Yeah.
When you're grandparents, you're not going to be like, Jimmy, when we were young, everyone died, and we were cannibals. It was amazing.
Well, and I wonder, too, if it's like, it's part of just a hope that the horrible catastrophe doesn't happen again, right?
We can all hope that it doesn't happen in our lifetime, but there's no reason we shouldn't teach everyone that it may happen. And that would create a society that's a little less lazy and a little bit more able to adapt.
Yes, and a little bit prepared. I mean, I said this very quickly at the end of our last episode, but I suggest that people embrace these possibilities for a bunch of reasons. I mean, you know, we've talked about this a lot, but you and I have like generally left the system because as much as we possibly can, because it's screwed up. And I mean, like something like this happening in some sense is sort of welcome because the world is so screwed up for the common person. So embrace it, and that gives you an opportunity to be prepared and be resourceful for whatever may come your way.
Because it's coming. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but it's coming.
Whether you like it or not, it's coming.
We love you. Be safe. Hey, become a Patreon at revolution.radio and support this awesome platform.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Hello, my name is Mr. Rowe. I am the host of Reality Extraction. Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. I utilize logic, intellect, and magic to methodically autonomize, vivisect, analyze, examine, study, scrutinize, and extract an essence of reality from a fog of illusion and confusion. You can find me on Studio B every Thursday at 1700 hours Pacific Time. That's 8 p.m. Eastern. No topic taboo, no subject too strange. I strive to take a neutral standpoint during the dissection of the topic at hand. That's Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe on Revolution Radio.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
I am Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning a